actually. I'm very impressed. Normally, when I come in here in the last morning of the course and I sit down, then often it's like still going, and then slowly people realize something, and then usually after quite some minutes, then people go shh. So very impressed. I think I've said quite a lot in the last 8 or 9 days. So I don't have a lot of new things to say, but maybe I can repeat some of the things that are important, and particularly for when we leave here, maybe some advice on that can help us to move forward. So for the last 8 or 9 days, we've been wandering around the Buddhist supermarket, and now we're at the checkout. Now, if you have something in your trolley to take home with you, don't do what I did 21 years ago when I did this course here. My trolley was overflowing with stuff, and I took it home and arranged it nicely on the shelves and thought, wow, that's really nice stuff. And that's where it stayed. So if you have something to take home with you, don't leave it on the shelf at home, meaning don't leave it as some nice memory, you know, oh, last year or year before, I had a really nice time there, very nice. Don't leave it like that, because it's not going to help you in your life. So if you've got something to take with you, then take it and use it, integrate it into your life to have a more meaningful life, you know, to help overcome your mental afflictions and suffering as well. Of course, shopping at the Buddhist supermarket, you don't need to buy everything. So what I'd recommend is to focus on those aspects that you find helpful. The things that you don't find helpful or you don't relate to, just leave them on the shelf in the supermarket, because maybe later they'll become useful. And of course, you don't need to be a Buddhist to shop at the Buddhist supermarket. In fact, we can follow some advice here from the Dalai Lama. Often when he teaches in Western countries, and particularly in a public audience where most people are not Buddhist, often one of the things he emphasizes is, please don't convert to Buddhism. Because if you grew up in a tradition or religion that is benefiting you, then if you try and convert to Buddhism, you maybe get confused. And then also, if you come from a conservative environment, you may have some difficulties as well. So he says, rather, if you grew up in a tradition that is working for you, then just, and you find some ideas that I'm telling you useful, then use those ideas to become a better Christian, a better Hindu, a better atheist, a better whatever you already are. And then he goes on to say, if you didn't grow up with a tradition, or the one you grew up with is not really benefiting you in any way, then eventually you may think about becoming a Buddhist. But the main important thing is not what you call yourself, but what you do with your life. So again, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes if we just simply label ourselves as a Buddhist, then often we think, oh, I'm okay because I'm a Buddhist, and we don't actually go and implement any of these ideas. So therefore, the main thing is not really what we call ourselves, but what we do with our life. One other piece of advice, no matter how tempting it may be, please do not force your family and friends to shop at the Buddhist supermarket. You know, often when we come to these sort of courses, we think, wow, my brother, sister, partner, mother, father, so on, could really use this in their life. And particularly if they already have an approach, or they're maybe a little bit close-minded, then if you go home and sort of force this onto them, you're going to have the opposite effect. And we know that from our own experience. If someone forces something onto us, even if it's the best thing for us, we usually reject it. So please don't do that. Of course, if the people at home are open-minded, yes, then please explain. But if they're not, particularly more elderly people tend to be more fixed in their ways, then one of the things to do that can really help is lead by example. You implement these ideas, become a better person. They will see that, and then they may ask you, "Well, wow, what are you doing? You know, you're more calm, more kind, compassionate than you used to be." And then you can explain, "Well, I'm doing this," and then you don't even have to use the word Buddhism. You can just talk about the things that you implemented in your life. So some general advice for when we leave here and go home. One is to avoid unrealistic expectations. As I've mentioned a number of times, expectations is really causes a lot of unnecessary obstacles. And here, again, please avoid the expectation that I had when I first did this course many years ago. And that was simply the idea that now that we have maybe some more intellectual knowledge, that somehow that this is going to change your life automatically. It won't. So if we want these ideas to start to change our life, we need to implement them. We need to internalize them in meditation. We need to integrate them into our daily life. Otherwise, they're just some nice ideas that really won't have any impact on us in our life. And again, avoid the expectation of a quick fix that, you know, I'm going to sort myself out within a week or two. It's not going to happen. And also, this idea of wanting a quick fix is a sure sign of craving and attachment. We're craving and attachment for some sort of experience or result. So let that go, and then just apply effort, and then whatever happens is okay. One expectation we definitely want to let go of is the expectation that my practice is going to go like this. I don't know anyone whose practice goes like this, meaning if we have the expectation that my practice should be as good as last week, probably a little bit better, we're going to get frustrated because in the short term there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. So to really let go of any expectation that, you know, it's going to be every week getting better and better and better. In the short term, a lot of variation. Of course, in the longer term, then there should be some improvement. So have a long-term perspective instead of short-term perspective. And also, as I've mentioned, we're talking about transforming our mind. So we're talking about inner transformation. So avoid making a big outward display of it. You know, as I mentioned, sometimes people, when they enter into a spiritual path, make a big outward display of it, wearing funky clothing and saying all sorts of things to people. I think this, one, is we've missed the point. And two, we're going to attract a lot of unnecessary obstacles doing this. And three, it's a sure sign that our spiritual practice is being hijacked by the ego. And now we're just dressing ourselves up as a spiritual ego. And as I mentioned before, I think spiritual ego can be one of the worst because often the spiritual ego has this air of superiority and looks down on others who are not spiritual. So we really want to let go of that. Is just let go of that and really look at changing ourselves internally and don't make a big outward display of it. Particularly if we're living in a community or society that is very conservative, if we go around saying, I'm a Buddhist, you're probably going to attract a lot of negative attention. So don't do that. Just implement the ideas, and if someone asks you, you're just saying, well, I'm trying to use these ideas. You don't even have to use the word Buddhism. I'm just trying to be more kind, more compassionate, and have less anger and jealousy. That's all we have to say. And, of course, if we want to progress, if we want to move in a good direction, then it's a little bit like the analogy of a little sprout, a seed that has sprouted. If we want the seed that sprouted to grow into a big plant, we need to do two things. We need to protect it and nurture it. Likewise, if any little sprout has germinated in our mind in this course, if we want that to become a reality and change our life, we need to do these two things. We need to protect it and nurture it. So to protect it, I would recommend that when we go home, if we have any heavy negative influences, people or things that overwhelm us in a negative way, then as a beginner, give yourself a little bit of space from that, because we're just going to get overwhelmed. Unfortunately, sometimes these very heavy negative influences can often be family members. So I'm not talking about abandoning family members. I'm just talking about having some physical space distance from them, keep them close to our heart, and then work on ourselves, and then we can be in that situation more later without becoming overwhelmed. So again, be very helpful to avoid unnecessary harmful situations that overwhelm us, particularly as a beginner. So that's protecting. And also nurturing then, and this is something that I've talked a little bit about and something that I emphasize more and more, is this idea of sangha, spiritual community. If we have the idea that, you know, I can do this on my own, I think you're going to find it extremely difficult, if not impossible. And I know from personal experience, when I did this course and one or two more courses in Kathmandu, I went back to Australia, wanted to transform my life. Where I went home to, there was no center, no one interested in this. And I wanted to change, I wanted to meditate, but basically for 2 years, nothing happened, because I just got swept up in my old habits and old routines, because I wasn't strong enough to move in a new direction by myself. It was only then, when I found myself in a spiritual community, that I managed to start to implement something. So I think we really need to think about this, is that if we really want to start to move in a better direction, we need help. We need support. Doesn't have to be a actual Buddhist center, but at least a group of people, like-minded people who are trying to do something similar, get associated, meet regularly, maybe even meditate a bit together, discuss things, get support. You can support them, because then we feel that we're not just the only one. And because if we feel like we're the only one, it's too difficult, we'll just give up. So therefore, very important. And of course, part of the nurturing is to continue to receive some instructions, reading books, but then of course also to meditate and integrate into our life. And also to help for that is to regular retreats. So I would recommend at least once, if possible twice a year, to attend a retreat. And as a beginner, very much helpful to do group retreat. If we try to do solitary retreat as a beginner, very difficult. We're not very disciplined. There's no structure. We have to motivate ourselves. Very difficult. So I'd recommend to start with group retreat. So instead of spending 2 weeks on the beach, maybe 1 week on the beach and 1 week doing some sort of retreat would be useful. Because in a group environment, of course, it's structure, it's led, you just have to turn up, and then you get the group energy as well supporting you. Once we start doing a little bit of that, then we can slowly start to do a little bit of personal retreat, maybe half a day or a weekend or something, and slowly build up like that. Now, of course, if we want to do these sorts of things, we need to simplify our lifestyle. Because often we hear people say, I want to meditate, but I don't have time to meditate. I think that's never a valid excuse. Of course, the reality is most of us have very hectic, busy lives, and we fill up our life with lots of stuff. Now, of course, some of those things we do are essential. Most of us probably need to have some sort of job, to have some income, to have a place to live and feed ourselves and so forth. And some of us also maybe have some family responsibilities and other responsibilities. But above and beyond these essential responsibilities, what we often do, of course, is we fill up our life with lots of stuff. And we tend to do that for two reasons. One is that in our modern society, it's often felt like if we're not doing something, we're not being productive. So just do something, anything, just do something. So we have this obsession about doing. And actually reminds me of I don't think I've mentioned it in this course yet. I often mention it because it's very interesting. is they did this study about this obsession about doing. They had people sit in a small white room, chair in the middle, nothing to attract their attention, plain room, and they just asked the people to sit there quietly for 15 minutes. They had one option other than sit there quietly for 15 minutes. And the other option was they gave each person a little device that could give themselves an electrical shock, which was unpleasant. That was the only thing that they could do. 65% of men preferred to shock themselves rather than sit there quietly. Women were a little bit better. Only 25% of women preferred to shock themselves. We have this obsession with doing. And again, the problem is as well, sitting quietly doing nothing, we get to see the state of our mind and we don't like what we see. So we just want to distract ourselves, just busy, just do anything, rather than see the mess that my mind is in. So therefore, that's why we fill up our life with lots of stuff for these reasons. So therefore, we simplify our life if we really want to devote ourselves to these sorts of things, to meditation, to improving ourselves in our life. Now, of course, what we can do is forcibly cut things out of our life, but then it's going to be always a struggle because they'll simply come back. So we really need to change our attitude. And to do that, we looked in this course, two things very helpful. Reflecting on precious human life and death. If we really reflect on these two things, we're going to see how such a precious life we have, and it's not going to last forever. We're not going to want to waste our life. And if we do these two reflections, what you're going to find is that a lot of this stuff, this that we fill up our life with, that doesn't really bring us anything, we're simply going to lose interest in doing it. We're just not going to want to do it because it's meaningless. We don't want to waste our life. And this is very much understood, particularly by people who've had the so-called near-death experiences. They've seen death directly and come back, so they can really appreciate the preciousness of life. Or someone who is about to die, they then understand the preciousness of life. As I said, I think earlier, often we only appreciate something if we've lost it or about to lose it. In fact, I saw recently there was a little article on the internet where this lady had a terminal illness. She only had months to live, and she was pleading with people not to waste their life on meaningless stuff because she could see that it's just a waste of time. And in fact, on that point, I've got two things that I'd like to share. First is there was an Australian nurse. She was working in the hospice field for 30 years or more, and she would, for looking after people who are terminally ill or about to die, and she would ask them what their biggest regrets in life were. And so then she, over the years, she came up with a list of the top five regrets of people who are dying. And I'd just like to share two of those with you. Now, the first one is that I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This was the most common regret of all. When people realize that their life is almost over and look back clearly on it, it is easy to see how many dreams have gone unfulfilled. Most people have not honored even a half of their dreams and had to die knowing it was due to the choices they made or have not made. Health brings a freedom very few realize until they no longer have it. And the second one is, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. This came from every male patient that I nursed. They missed their children's youth and their partner's companionship. Women also spoke of this regret, but as most were from an older generation, many of the female patients had not been breadwinners. All of the men I nursed deeply regretted spending so much of their lives on the treadmill of a work existence. And then very briefly, the other three were, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. I wish that I had let myself be happier. This is surprisingly a common one. Many did not realize until the end that happiness is a choice. And then one other thing I'd like to share on that, related to that, is I'd like to read two paragraphs from a speech made by Steve Jobs. I think everyone who knows Steve Jobs, the ex-CEO of Apple. This speech he made more than 10 years ago to students at Princeton University in the States. Just two paragraphs. He says the following. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations or pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. So I think some very good advice there. And on that point, another related thing is, then often when people sort of really get the understanding that they want to really make their life meaningful, then often people come up with this sort of problem or choice. Often people go, well, should I do the career thing or should I do the spiritual thing, you know? And often people then think about abandoning their career and doing a spiritual life. I think this way of thinking is not helpful, because if we abandon our career, one is, how are we going to financially support ourselves? And two, maybe the thing we've abandoned is the one thing we're good at, the one way in which we can actually use our talents to benefit society. So if we've given that up, what are we going to do? Are we going to live in a cave for the rest of our life? So rather, we need to integrate, is use your talents in a better way to inspire others to benefit society. And on that very point, actually during this course, I received an email from a student who did a course with me here 2 years ago, and I'd like to share a little bit what he said. He said the following. About 2 years ago, I participated in your 7-point mind training course at Tushita. And many times during the past 2 years, I was thinking about sending you a mail and telling you how much those 9 precious days meant to me and how much in my life sparked out of the inspiration and insights gathered during those days. After the course, I returned home and picked up my life just where I left it, teaching science in high school. But so much had changed. My approach to my work, my life, my friends, and my pupils had changed. Some weeks into the term, I was teaching 11-year-olds for the first time in my life. I started beginning my sessions. I started beginning my sessions with a little awareness exercises. Those youngsters are so bouncy after the breaks, so I was looking for a method to get them focused in class without using force. I taught the benefits of sitting upright for keeping focused, and then little awareness exercises like observing the breath, listening to sounds, tasting chocolate properly, and so on. It took around 3 minutes before the beginning of the class, but somehow it changed everything. To my amazement, the kids just loved doing these exercises. I started to use these techniques also in my other classes from 14 to 18-year-olds, and the same thing happened. They started to demand the exercises, and somehow using those methods, it created a real bonding between my students and myself, culminating in my students asking me to make the speech at their prom at the end of their high school years, which was pretty amazing. So I think we can do that. So, of course, if we want to progress, we need continuity is the key to success. So practice, of course, is two parts, meditation and integrating into life. So, again, I'm going to talk now about how to do those two aspects, how to really, and I think Renato probably mentioned a little bit about the meditation side, but maybe I can mention a few more points, and then how we can integrate things into our life. So the core practices that we saw in this course were those three: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So, of course, ethical lifestyle as the basis. And on that basis, to do the concentration practice, the shamatha practice, to really cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind. Because if we can really cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind, not only will that, of course, have direct benefit in our life, meaning we'll be much more calm, more effective in everything we do, but it's the basis of all other practices. It's the basis of our vipassana, our compassion practices, and so on. And then, of course, the third is the wisdom, the vipassana, to really gain insight into ourselves and the world around us, how we exist and the world around us exists. And, of course, we need to balance that with the compassion wing of the practice. So let's have a look at how we can set up our day in a good way. So daily meditation practice, of course, very, very helpful. And generally it's very much recommended to do the meditation first thing in the morning, because that's when we're most fresh, usually most quiet where we are, and also, of course, a very good way to start the day. And also very helpful to start the day with a good motivation, and that can lead us into the day in a good way. I've got an example here from the Dalai Lama, and he says the following: every day, think as you wake up, today I am fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. I am going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others. I'm going to have kind thoughts towards others. I'm not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. And the short version of that is, every day, think as you wake up, I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. Now, in terms of the meditation practice, very much recommended to do it at the same time every day. Because one of the most difficult things is just to develop the habit. So if we keep changing the time when we meditate, we're not really developing the habit. So if we have a time and stick to that, then after some time it becomes a habit. It becomes a lot easier to do it. And I think modern studies show that we have to do something at least 25 or 30 times in a row to even begin to develop a habit. And with meditation, the key phrase is quality over quantity, meaning much better to meditate in a focused way for 20 minutes than sit there for an hour just getting dull and distracted. So always emphasize quality over quantity. How long to meditate, of course, will depend on us as an individual, our level of capacity. I mean, in this retreat, this course, generally we've had these roughly 20-minute sessions with Renato, often the 45-minute session split into two. So 20, 25 minutes for many people as a beginner can be a good amount of time. For some of us as beginners, maybe a little bit shorter. For some of us, can be a bit longer. So we can judge that for ourselves. How we can judge if we're meditating too long? One way is, are we losing enthusiasm Is our enthusiasm the same at the end as it was at the beginning? If it's dropping off, we're meditating too long. So keep it short. If you want to meditate longer in the morning, but you can't sustain it, then like here, break it into two 20-minute sessions, or even three 15-minute sessions. Keep them short, little break in between. Now, also very much recommended to meditate the same amount of time. So it's good to have a timer. Because if we don't set a timer, what can often happen is two things. One is, on days where things are not going well, things are quite difficult, maybe we're very agitated or negative state of mind, and we can't really get into the practice, then often after 5 or 10 minutes we go, okay, it's too difficult today, I give up. That's not a good habit to develop. Because one of the things we definitely need in meditation, but also in daily life, is perseverance. If every time things get a little bit difficult, we give up, we're not going to progress. So if we set a timer, even if things are a little bit difficult, we'll persevere. We'll develop the habit of perseverance. So that's very good. And then other days, if we don't set a timer, and other days when things are maybe going well, then of course what we do is, oh, things are going really well this morning. We just keep meditating. And then, of course, we keep meditating till when? Until it starts not going so well, and then we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending in frustration or dullness or distraction, we're going to start to associate meditation experiences with not very pleasant experiences. We're not going to want to meditate again the next day. Whereas if we set a timer, it's gone well, the timer goes and we stop, we remember that. And then we'll be enthusiastic, we'll want to meditate again the following day. And sometimes I even see in traditions, I've seen that it says, when your meditation starts to go well, stop, because that's what you remember. Then you'll be enthusiastic to continue. But at least, you know, if the timer goes, then stop, and that's what we remember, we'll want to meditate again the following day. What to meditate on in the morning? And probably Renato's mentioned a few things, but I'll mention a couple things myself. I think if we're the sort of person who doesn't have very good attention skills, you know, we're often prone to a lot of dullness and distraction, then I think it would be very useful to emphasize the shamatha practice in the morning. Because if we don't, if we just do, say, vipassana or compassion or something, you probably find that they're not going to be very effective because you're distracted and dull. It's not really going to penetrate these meditations. Therefore, work on the shamatha practice, establish a more calm, more clear, more focused mind. Then we can use that for the other practices. What I wouldn't recommend is just doing shamatha in the morning and no other meditations. This is a little bit unbalanced, particularly not doing any compassion work. Because what can happen is if we only do shamatha practice, particularly if we start to get some benefits, some quieting of the mind, then what can happen is we can go, oh, that shamatha is so nice. It's so peaceful and calm. I like that. And what we can do then is use the shamatha practice as a way of withdrawing from all that mess out there. So then we can become very self-absorbed and disconnected from the world. And of course, if anyone disturbs our little bubble of peace, watch out. So we really don't want to go in that direction. We don't want to use our shamatha practice as simply as a way of withdrawing into our own little sphere of isolation, of peace from the world. Therefore, balance that with compassion, loving kindness, and then also vipassana. Because the vipassana practice is going to help us to start to eliminate our mental afflictions by gaining insight into impermanence, no self, emptiness, and so forth. So we can bring in some vipassana practice as well. And so what we can do then, even on the days where we're doing vipassana or compassion or tonglen, is start maybe with 5 or 10 minutes of shamatha, calm the mind, and then go into the other practice, the analytical style meditation. Now, when we're beginning to listen, to do these meditations, then particularly the analytical meditations, which may have a lot of steps, it may be useful to start by listening to the guided meditations, the audio of that. And in fact, during this course, we've recorded everything, and so we're going to make the audio available for this course to everyone. So I think what's going to happen is also we're going to do a group photo at the end this morning, and that's going to be uploaded, I think, onto the Tushita Facebook page, and then there'll be also a link there, probably to Dropbox, that has the audio for this course, so then you can download the audio. And then you can use this audio, you can listen to the classes again to refresh our understanding, but also you can use the audio from the meditation sessions to listen to those for some time to get familiar with the practice. But then what I'd recommend is not keep listening, because then often we get a bit lazy and we're not really doing the practice. So once we understand the steps of the practice, then don't use the guided audio anymore, and then do it ourselves. But then maybe over some time, maybe it's good to come back, because maybe over time we've started to sort of adjust our technique a little bit and we're sort of not really doing the right practice anymore. So maybe after some weeks or months, it may be useful to listen to the audio again to make sure that we're actually doing the practice well. And also sometimes that can be a little bit inspirational as well, to listen to someone guiding it. Then how to integrate these various practices into daily life. I think the key here is mindfulness. That, of course, we can have the aspiration to want to integrate all these things into our life. But the reality is, of course, is that we have very strong habits, and that we're probably just going to get caught up in our habits. And often in our daily life, we really tend to be stimulus reaction machines. We receive some stimulus. Before we know it, we've reacted out of habit. And often our habits are not very good. So to start to change that, we need mindfulness. Because if we can develop mindfulness, and mindfulness, of course, is what we are developing in the shamatha practice, then if we have mindfulness, more mindfulness in the daily life, instead of simply reacting out of habit, we can notice the stimulus, and we can then, instead of reacting, we can have a moment to reflect on that situation in a different way and respond in a better, more constructive way. But we can only begin to do that if we have mindfulness. So mindfulness, of course, is what we are strengthening in the shamatha practice, but also we need to actively cultivate mindfulness throughout the day. Of course, at the beginning of the day, we can simply say, okay, I'm going to be as mindful as possible throughout the day. But probably after 5 minutes, we'll probably forget that. So, therefore, we need to remind ourselves to be mindful. And so, therefore, we can use certain triggers to remind us to be mindful in the day. And those triggers can take a number of forms. One is to pick certain activities that we regularly do each day, and then always make a strong determination to be mindful in those activities. One classic example, of course, is brushing the teeth. We usually do that 2, maybe 3 times a day. And often what we're doing, of course, in the morning is we're quickly brushing our teeth because we're running late and we're already thinking about all the things we have to do that day. We run out the door and then we go, did I brush my teeth? And we don't even remember. That's how mindless we were. So therefore, when you're brushing your teeth, focus on brushing your teeth. And not be doing one thing and thinking of something else. That's not helpful. That's distraction. So when we're brushing the teeth, be focused on the sensations of the brush on the gum and everything associated with brushing the teeth. Another classic example that is very helpful is eating meals. So often again, now we're not very mindful when we're eating meals. Often we're caught up in our conceptual mind And of course, if we're at work at lunch, often we don't have much time for lunch. So we're gulping down the food quickly because we have to get back to work. So we're not even really enjoying the food and probably not digesting it well either. So when we're eating food, be present with the sensations of the chewing and so forth. And what you're going to find is not only is this a mindfulness exercise, but you're going to find you're going to enjoy your food much more than you do now. So pick a few of these sort of activities and really be present in those activities. And also related to that, what is very helpful is in our daily life, of course, sometimes we need to think. So think when you need to think, but then switch off the conceptual mind when you don't need to think. Otherwise, we get into obsessive, compulsive thinking, which often torments us. So therefore, very helpful is not to get caught up in conceptual mind unless we need to think about something. Particularly helpful here is when we are engaged in any physical activity, i.e. walking down the street, eating meals, exercising, whatever, be present in the senses. Be present with that physical exercise. You know, if we're playing sport, playing a musical instrument, whatever we're doing in daily life, be present with that experience. Get out of the conceptual mind and into the body, into the physical world. And you're going to enjoy whatever physical activity you do much more. You'll be much more focused. And so this is also going to be very helpful for developing mindfulness and also to start to overcome this obsessive compulsive thinking. Also, of course, triggers, we can use modern technology as an aid. And that is now, of course, on our smartphones, there are certain apps which we can program that will give us a little trigger, a little buzzer or bell or something at regular intervals. You know, we can maybe program it roughly on once an hour to give a little bell, a signal. And when we hear that, then immediately stop whatever we're doing and just sit and focus on your breath for 3 breaths. That's it. Or, if you prefer, look at your mind for the duration of 3 breaths. Very short exercise. Don't make it too complicated, otherwise we're not going to do it. But if you keep it very short, like just stopping and then just noticing sensations in the body for 3 breaths or focusing on the breath for 3 breaths, then continue what you're doing. If we do this even once an hour, you'll find you're going to start to more instinctively have the habit of being present, being mindful. So this can be very helpful also to improve our mindfulness throughout the day. Also very helpful, avoid this cognitive fusion that I've mentioned a number of times in this course, particularly in situations that are either pleasant or unpleasant, is avoid the cognitive fusion. Because if we do the cognitive fusion for pleasant situations, we're going to get caught up in craving and attachment to that thing or that person. Or unpleasant situations, if we do cognitive fusion, we're going to get caught up in aversion to that thing or maybe start getting very hostile towards the person or, of course, toward ourselves. So really start to have the correct perspective and try to also avoid language which reinforces that cognitive fusion. Also related to that is to you investigate appearances, meaning this is part of the Vipassana practice, the daily life Vipassana practice. So the meditative Vipassana practice, of course, is to meditate on things like impermanence and no self and emptiness. The daily life Vipassana practice is to investigate appearances, particularly, again, in any situation that provokes a pleasant or unpleasant experience. Investigate appearances. For pleasant experiences, we can really then say, look at that person or thing that is a stimulus for the pleasant experience. Where is the attractiveness or beauty in that person or thing? Can I find it? Or if it's unpleasant, where is the ugliness in that object or person? And of course, also, we can apply that to ourselves. If we are starting to get angry or irritated, then we can apply that same investigation to ourselves. Where is the person here who is getting angry or irritated or has a lot of craving? If we search here, we don't find, those mental afflictions will vaporize, they'll dissipate. So therefore, really start questioning appearances, and that's going to help us feed back into the Vipassana or emptiness practice. Similarly, when we're faced with difficult situations in our life, in difficult situations, applying Vipassana means to look at me or the difficult situation or the difficult person to see, is there in something inherently difficult or bad in that person or thing or myself? But also we can use the compassion wing of practice in difficult situations in our life, not just the wisdom wing. And that is to really see difficult situations not as problems and obstacles, but as opportunities. Because if we are confronted with a difficult situation in our life and we label that as problem or obstacle, all that happens is we immediately have aversion because we don't want problems. And that aversion, all that will do, it will magnify our level of discomfort or suffering. That's not helpful at all. And then often, because we do that, then we often react to that difficult situation in inappropriate ways that doesn't help to overcome the problem. Often it makes it worse. So therefore, if we can see difficult situations not as problems but as opportunities, because actually the times in our life where we most developed as a person was not when things were going well. Because when things are going well in our life, we often sort of float along, not really developing as a person. It's only when we're confronted with difficult situations that challenge us, that help us to improve as a person. So if we can see these difficult situations as opportunities, of course they'll be difficult, but then we won't have the aversion and we'll look at ways to overcome this difficult situation and develop as a person. And so, therefore, when we already talked about that in terms of suffering, when we see suffering, then particularly when it's our own suffering, if we see that as a problem, we're just going to have aversion and we're going to suffer more. So rather, practice acceptance and use Shanti Deva's advice. If the situation can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. And if the situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? This too will pass. So therefore, we can then not have aversion and not magnify suffering. But on top of that, we can make that suffering situation meaningful by understanding that, well, I'm not the only one who's suffering on the planet at the moment. There are countless thousands, maybe millions of other people who are suffering as well. And then the situation where you have some physical suffering or even mental suffering experience that you can't immediately resolve, you can say, by me willingly accepting this, may all others be free of their problems. And so then we can do this Tonglen exercise, taking on the suffering of others, giving them happiness. So then we can use our difficult situation in a meaningful way. So this is how we can also work with difficult situations in our life. And then also, of course, it's very good to end the day on a good note. Of course, if we have time and energy to do another meditation session in the evening, very good. Many of us, maybe we're a little bit tired, maybe we've got family commitments, social commitments or something in the evening. I think what we can all do each evening is two things. One is, before we go to bed, is review our day. How did our day go? And then if we notice that we got caught up in any negative behavior, then we can do these four opponent powers that we talked about, this purification practice. So if we noticed we got caught up in some negative behavior during the day, then regret, not guilt, because again, guilt is cognitive fusion. We don't need to feel guilty about that. Sincere regret for having done that thing. Reaffirm, the second one was the reliance. Reaffirm the positive direction we want to follow our life. Third one was think of some sort of practical remedy for that. And then the fourth, make a strong determination not to do that the following day. In that way, we can sort of reduce that negative habit and tendency. And also then we can sort of let go of that negativity because we've sort of dealt with it. Whereas if we don't do that, often if we have engaged in some harmful behavior, then often not only do we beat ourselves up, but it churns over and over and over and over in our mind and we can't sleep because of that. So also when we do this, we can let go of it as well because we've done the regret and maybe we've say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to apologize to the person. So then we've dealt with it, you know, even though maybe we're still to do the action, but we've dealt with it. But equally important, maybe even more important in our modern world, is also review our day and reflect on all the good things we did during the day. Because again, in our modern society, we have this obsessive focus on the negative. And we tend to do that focus on the negative with cognitive fusion. So we end up with a fixed, biased view of ourselves, and we end up with guilt and low self-esteem. So therefore, to overcome that, reflect on the positive things we did during the day. And also, you can reflect on if you saw people around you during the day doing good things, also to rejoice in that. So then reflect on the good things we did during the day and then rejoice in having done that. And don't praise yourself because this is cognitive fusion. That's just going to give you a big head. So we don't want to be praising ourselves. Praise our behavior, rejoice in our behavior, and then make a strong determination to continue that good behavior the following day. So that's going to help us to increase our positive actions. And also then we can have a balanced view of ourselves and a healthy view of ourselves. If we're doing this review, don't make it too involved. Because if we make it too long, we're going to give up on it. So what I'd recommend is keep it short and maybe pick the top three negative, top three positive, and focus on that. Otherwise, if you do this for a long time, probably you're going to go, it takes too much time. So keep it short again, and then we'll do it. And then the second thing we all can do each day, at the end of the day, is when we go to bed, go into the Shavasana posture, the corpse posture. So lying flat on your back, hands to the side, palms upwards, and then do a mindfulness exercise. Little shamatha practice, focusing on sensations in the body, emphasizing on every out-breath relaxation. And so this is a shamatha practice, a mindfulness practice, but often it's very helpful because often we've led very hectic day, minds churning over, and often when we go to bed, the body's tense, the mind's tense, and we can't sleep. So therefore, with this practice, not only are we improving mindfulness, we can release the tension in the body, release the tension in the mind. And then do that practice as long as we can maintain some alertness, which may only be a few minutes, maybe 5-10 minutes. And then when we start to get a bit drowsy, then mentally note, okay, my meditation's finished. And then move out of that posture into whatever posture you use for sleep. So if you only use this posture for meditation, then you're going to start to associate that posture with meditation. So if you're going to do this for meditation, I wouldn't recommend using that posture also for resting and sleeping, because then when you lie in that posture, instead of being able to meditate, you're just going to get drowsy and sleepy. So therefore, only use this posture for meditation. And then when the meditation's finished, make that mental note, meditation's finished, and then physically move out of that position. And then I think you'll find over time that you can use this posture to be completely relaxed and still quite alert. I really like this posture a lot. I use it a lot, particularly in the evening, and I find it very, very helpful to relax, but also to be alert And of course, you can use that posture as your normal meditation posture in the morning. If you're the sort of person who's very tense and agitated, this posture may in fact be the best posture for you to meditate. However, if you're also a person who gets easily drowsy in meditation, maybe the Shavasana is not the posture for you because you're just going to get very drowsy. So we have to check. Again, if we have a lot of tightness and tension normally sitting upright, maybe this is the one we use as our normal posture. So that's how we can end the day. One or two more things I want to mention about reading and so forth, but maybe before I do that, if there's any questions about anything I've talked about so far.
You mentioned about clear dreams. You said, in one day you said it's really easy to start a clear dream.
Sorry?
I don't know.
During the course or this morning?
Like when you're waking, such a dream.
Oh, normally when people in the morning, when they get up, that's normally where things are most quiet around them. Or actually, on that point, I want to add something is, and again, here, I'm a firm believer if modern technology can help us, use it. But often modern technology is a distraction. But here, what you'll find in my experience is, of course, if we're meditating and there's a lot of noise around, very difficult to meditate. Noise is a big, difficult thing. So when I'm in an environment where it's very noisy, I use noise-canceling headphones. Fantastic. They're quite expensive, but well worth it. Particularly when I'm traveling and so forth, in planes and so forth, if there's a lot of noise, I use noise-canceling headphones. So I really recommend them if you're in a noisy environment. Very, very helpful. But then back to your point is, in the morning, of course, is normally the time where things are most quiet around us and also where people are most fresh, and it's a good way to start the day. Having said that, everyone is different physiology, and even mentions this in the meditation text sometimes. My own personal experience is that when I'm doing meditation retreats, I'm just meditating throughout the day. As a generalization, the times where I find I'm most clear and focused is not early in the morning, but rather late afternoon, early evening. So when I'm in meditation retreat, then because that's the time where I'm most clear and focused, I often use that time for shamatha practice. And when I'm not actually as clear, then I use it for other types of meditations. But of course, if we have a normal lifestyle, working lifestyle, then even if we're more clear later in the day, we're probably at work or be tired or whatever. So probably we can't do a meditation then early evening when we're maybe fresh or when we're focused. So therefore, it's very much recommended to do the meditation practice first thing in the morning. Of course, if we're the sort of person that does shift work, maybe we're working at night time, then, you know, we can do it when we first wake up from our sleep, which may be in the afternoon, for example.
I was asking about dreaming.
Oh, dreaming, okay.
You spoke about
lucid dreaming, yeah. Yeah, so, yes, lucid dreaming can be helpful. One, to understand how our mind can create a very, very real, vivid reality. But also, of course, then, in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, then they use lucid dreaming in the practice. So then you're not just doing lucid dreaming just to have a nice experience, but, and also you can develop lucid sleep, which is more difficult, but you can be lucid in deep sleep as well. You can know that you're in deep sleep. More subtle, more difficult, but possible. And in those two occasions, if we become lucid, we can use that state and meditate. For example, in a lucid dream, we can meditate on emptiness, if we're as part of the practice. So in Tibetan Buddhism, there are what's called dream yoga and sleep yoga for doing that, but also to help prepare for the time of death. Because remember I said that the process of falling asleep into dream state and waking again is a sort of similar process to through the death process. So if we can develop the capacity to maintain mindfulness through falling asleep and be mindful in deep sleep, mindful in dreaming, and then mindful back into waking. If we can do that, then that can be good preparation to maintain, being able to maintain mindfulness through the death process. And again, the purpose of that is that when we get to that clear light of death, being mindful, we can stay there and meditate on emptiness, and then hope, in the best case, achieve enlightenment. So this is the purpose for developing lucid dreaming and lucid sleep in Buddhism. But generally, you won't find any instruction on that until you sort of go into tantra level of practice. But if you're interested now in just developing the capacity to lucid dreaming, there are quite a number of good books around on lucid dreaming. The one man who I think was at Stanford University, he did his PhD on lucid dreaming many years ago, and he's sort of considered to be the father of lucid dreaming because he really brought it into the public sphere 30 years ago or more, Stephen LaBerge. So he has a lot of stuff, but he's not a Buddhist, so it's just pure lucid dreaming for him. Alan Wallace, who I quoted a number of times in this course, he, in his own practice, does a lot of lucid dreaming's work. But he, of course, is doing it more on a Buddhist perspective, and he's written a book recently called Dreaming Yourself Awake. Dreaming Yourself Awake. And so that's more about lucid dreaming and using it in the spiritual path. But one little short piece of advice on how to... There are many approaches to develop lucid dreaming, but one thing that they often recommend to start to develop that ability is simply set the intention. That when you go to sleep, as you're going to sleep, set the intention that tonight, when I'm dreaming, I'm going to become aware that I'm dreaming. Just doing that is very helpful. And I mentioned this actually once in an introduction course some years ago, earlier in the course. And then the very next day, a student came and said, I had a lucid dream last night. And all they did was, when they went to bed, I want to be aware of dreaming when I'm dreaming. And he had the experience. But, of course, no guarantee. But this is the first point, is to have that intention. And then, of course, there are many things you can do. And these lucid dreaming books give many ways of doing that. One of the difficult approaches to develop lucid dreaming is to maintain awareness while you're falling asleep. So you can go into lucid dreaming and lucid sleep from the waking state by just simply remaining mindful through the falling asleep process. This is not so easy. There are other methods to cause yourself to become lucid with this called dream signs and that. But anyway, it's a whole topic, so read about it if you're interested.
Can you mention both names again? The one that wrote the book and the other one?
Well, the person who did a lot of pioneering work in lucid dreaming was Stephen LaBerge. B-La and then B-E-R-G-E. And then, of course, Alan Wallace, who I've quoted a number of times, he does a lot of lucid dream work. And so he's written a book called Dreaming Yourself Awake. Yeah. Difficult situations. You can question the appearances. Yeah. Correct.
In the situation, but...
And you can direct it yourself. You can go, where is the me that's getting agitated and irritated here? And look for the me as well.
And is that something that was just from your own, you would do it in the moment, or you just recognize?
Of course, to be able to begin to do this, we need a little bit of mindfulness, because otherwise we've already reacted and it's too late. Secondly, we need to have some understanding about emptiness and dependent arising, and we need to have meditated a bit so that it becomes easier for us to think like that in the moment. If we're not familiar with these things, then it's not going to happen. But the more we can reflect on emptiness, the more we can meditate on it, And the more we have mindfulness, the more when this difficult situation starts to arise, the more we can, just in a moment, we can go, where's the me who's getting irritated? And because we've done that reflection and meditation, looking for the me again and again in meditation, that looking at me is not like something that takes 5 minutes. It can be very quick. It can be very quick. We can look, no me to be found, and then that will just dissolve. But again, it implies we've developed a bit of mindfulness and we have done some reflection and meditation on emptiness. Otherwise, I think it's not going to work.
Back to the lucid dreaming.
Sure.
And meditation. We talked a lot about concentration, the shamatha, and the analytical.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard from several people like experiences where they had meditations that sounded like lucid dreaming. They're just sitting and then, I don't know, experiencing something like a dream or like a lucid dream in the meditation. Is it a more developed or just a different technique of meditation? Or
I'm not exactly sure what you're meaning, because one thing we have to be careful of is that in meditation, we can have all sorts of appearances arising, and often they're just sort of hallucinations, really, and not to get caught up in them. But also, of course, if we're really doing, particularly if we're doing the Vipassana emptiness meditation, then we're doing some sort of analytical thing where there are a lot of appearances, we can experientially see the whole thing like an illusion. You know, there's no me here separate from that experience and so forth. So that can happen, sure. But we need to be a little bit careful that to know whether something is a genuine experience or we're just sort of hallucinating, you know. Meditation texts warn a lot about that, you know, misinterpreting experiences. So we need to be a little bit careful how we interpret those experiences. Otherwise, we can come up with some strange ideas. Yeah. No lama. You mean, yeah. So then you do that as long as you can be alert. Maybe after 2 minutes you get drowsy and then you go, okay, my meditation's finished, and then move out. So just do it as long as you can be a little bit focused. When you get very sleepy, mentally note, finished my meditation, and then physically move out of that position. Okay. Two more things and then I'll finish. Reading material. There's a reading list in the back of your red booklet. Within that, a couple of books that I can really recommend. For the shamatha practice, I think The Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace is very good, very well written. Attention Revolution, it's in your book, red book at the back.
Under the mindfulness heading.
Under the mindfulness heading in your booklet at the back. Attention Revolution by Alan Wallace, very well written book. He talks about the breath practice, the mind practice, the awareness practice. And also in that book, he has one chapter on each of the four immeasurables. He has a chapter on compassion, chapter on loving kindness, empathetic joy, equanimity. And he also has one or two chapters on lucid dreaming, dream yoga in there as well. If you want to do a little bit of reading about the emptiness practice, I think a good book to start with is How to See Yourself as You Really Are by the Dalai Lama. Again, very clearly written, very simply written, and can be very helpful as a starting point. And then anyone who's interested in Vajrayana or Tantra and wants to get some idea of what it's about, particularly from a modern psychology perspective, a very good book is called Psychology of Buddhist Tantra. Again, it's in your reading list, from Rob Preece. He's a Buddhist, English Buddhist practitioner. He's done a lot of meditation retreats up the hills here, and he's a trained psychologist. He has his own psychology practice in the UK. So, very well written book, particularly understanding Tantra from the Western psychology perspective. And then in general, I find books from the Dalai Lama very clearly written. So I find those very well written. But then there are masses of books, and it really depends on the sort of type of person we are, which one sort of resonates with us. So there's a lot of books to look for out there. Now, in terms of doing, I mentioned it would be good, helpful to do regular retreats once a year, maybe twice a year if you can manage, and to start with group retreats, and then we can slowly move to solitary. The reality is to find a good group retreat, not so easy to find anywhere in the world. Not easy. One thing that relatively is available in many countries in the world, of course, is the Goenka Vipassana retreat, like next door. It's available in many countries, and of course it's by donation, so it's affordable. Because often group retreats in Europe and the US and Australia can be very expensive because of the venue. But Goenka retreat is by donations affordable. And so usually for that reason, I recommend them because they're easily available and they're affordable. What we need to realize, of course, Goenka retreat is very intense retreat. 10 days, 10 hours a day of sitting. It's very hardcore. So I don't recommend it to people as the very first thing. I would recommend do a course like this, do a little bit of meditation, get a little bit of understanding, a bit of meditation background. Then you have a bit of basis for it, but it is intense. A similar retreat to that that's not as intense is the Thai Vipassana, where they often do sort of sitting, walking. So check it out, but again, it's not for everyone. But what I find is the Goenka retreat is very intense, and because of that, often by the end of the 10 days, people have and often they say it's the most difficult thing they've ever done in their life. When I did it, it was the most difficult thing I'd ever done in my life because I did it as the very first thing next door here. I don't recommend that. But having done it, often at the end, people can understand the power of the mind and the value of meditation, how meditation can really start to transform our life. And so even if we don't continue to do that particular practice, often people get some inspiration that, you know, meditation can really help, that that can really change their perspective and their mind. I try to run also retreats in various places around the world. I have my own website. GlennSvensson.org, so you can check my schedule on there if I'm running a retreat in your neighbourhood and sometime in the future. Now I'm going to be running a couple of short retreats in Sydney and Melbourne in January in Australia, and then a little bit later next summer I'm going to be around Europe. Particularly in August I'm going to be in Israel for 3 weeks, so then check it out if you're there. Also, the one retreat I do every year, usually in July, is I run a retreat in Estonia, in Europe, and I've been running it there for 5 years, every summer. It's a beautiful place, little clearing in the forest. We book the whole place, and for European standards, it's very cheap. Normally, for about 9-day retreat, all-inclusive, about €300. So very cheap and beautiful place, very quiet, and I go there every year, and I'm going back there next July. I'm running 2 retreats there next July, a 8 or 9 day shamatha and then an 8 or 9 day vipassana. So usually that appears on my website around Christmas, so if you're around in Europe in the summer, very nice place to go, so check it out. Okay, that's all I wanted to mention on that. And also on my website, I have a contact page. So if anyone has any questions, also there's lots of audio on there. I've got audio from other courses and retreats I lead. So you just help yourself to whatever you find, and lots of materials on there. And then if you want to, there's also a contact page on there. So if you want to ask me a question, just send me a message and I'll try and answer any questions you have in the future. So that's all I wanted to say this morning. So my time is sort of I've run over time, actually. So I'd just like to finish, although Renato's not here, he's escaped. I wanted to first thank Renato for leading all the meditations in this course. And then, of course, lastly, I'd like to thank all of you for making the time and effort to come here to attend this course. And I really hope that you got something out of this course. And if you did, again, please take it home with you, use it, integrate it into your life to have a more meaningful life, and in particular to help benefit people around you as well. So thank you very much.